On the Bookshelf with your host, Dave Doc Kirby.
Welcome to a very special On the Bookshelf. As a little boy, I can remember watching television and seeing fire hoses turned on little black children and police dogs turned loose on little black children and turning to my parents and asking, what is going on? Here to talk today about her new book, Behind the Magic Curtain, from New South Books, is award-winning author, former police captain T.K. Thorne, who has an amazing narrative of the years essentially starting from about 1961, although there are some other things that she talks about prior to that, but primarily between 1961 and 1968, things that happened in Birmingham during the Civil Rights Movement. Captain Thorne, thank you so much for being with us today on the Bookshelf.
Thank you so much for having me, and just call me TK, please.
Oh, okay, very good. Were you a police captain in Birmingham?
Yes, I started out, of course, as a street officer, but by the time I retired after a couple of decades, I was a captain and a precinct captain.
Did you see any of these things?
When you were talking about your childhood experience, that mirrors mine precisely. I was about 9 years old in 1963, and I remember watching the television and turning to my parents and saying, what is this about?
Yeah.
What's going
on? It's a shocking thing for a kid to see something like that on television, but the story of how that came to be and the interesting interplay between just all sorts of people in Birmingham, the determined racist, the Klan, and then a group that was the National States Rights Party that even the Klan considered to be thugs. I'm thinking, that's got to be pretty scary.
That is pretty scary.
And then you had the incoming governor during part of this time. The outgoing governor and the incoming governor both were very determined segregationists, despite whatever Governor Wallace thought about the 1958 election. He changed his tune to win in 62. And so you have those folks on one side and Bull Connor, this very racist police chief, the commissioner of public safety, all on one side. And then on the other side, you have all kinds of people. Some are white folks who are gradualists. Some of them are Jewish, who certainly feel a solidarity with African Americans. There are people like Fred Shuttlesworth, a lawyer and a fierce civil rights advocate. We have the SCLC. We have Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King. We just have a lot of players on the table here. You managed to weave them all together into an understandable and a sensible thing. But the one person that I'd never heard of before I read your book comes across as, in a way, part of the hero status here, Tom Lankford, who was an ace reporter with the Birmingham News. And
yes, Tom was everywhere. He had his ears out and his camera up and reported on all kinds of things, including things that were going on inside the police department that were not public knowledge. And he died recently, unfortunately, but I was really, really fortunate to have about 8 years working with him.
Wow.
On these stories.
Well, I think that's what gives it such a great sense of being there as it's all happening, the kind of things that he saw happen. And interestingly enough, here he was a reporter, but he seems to have some skill as with technology, the technology of the day, and helps the FBI with wiretapping, which was legal at that point, and so forth. So he's a pretty interesting character. There are some surprises in this book. There was a line about Governor Bibb Graves. There have been buildings that used to bear his name across university campuses across the state, and they're not on those buildings, some of them anymore, because he was endorsed by the Klan when he ran for governor. But in your book, you say he became a progressive reformer and abolished the corrupt and brutal convict leasing system, which I'd read about, which was a horrendous thing during the Jim Crow era.
Yes, and he was not the only person that was a member of the Klan and turned out to be a progressive. Justice Black came from Birmingham.
Right.
And at one time he was a member of the Klan too, and he eventually became a Supreme Court justice that was sitting with many of the breakthrough legislation, or excuse me, case law from the Supreme Court during that era. And he was not, and it was not the only example of someone who was a, you know, I'm not sure what Gray's thoughts were at the time, or Black, but there were other characters who started out as being, you know, very entrenched segregationists and led efforts to get rid of Bull Connor and move the city forward. There's a lot of ironies that I found that were just fascinating.
Tom Lankford, even though he stood against most of the kind of stuff that Bull Connor was most famous for being in favor of, nonetheless, Bull Connor kind of respected his integrity and maybe protected him, or maybe just kept the forces at bay from going after him. And he also managed to interview the guy who had become the Imperial Wizard of the Ku Klux Klan, Robert Shelton. Shelton apparently kind of protected Lankford a little bit, even though he knew that Lankford didn't agree with his stance. I found that particularly interesting.
There's all kinds of interesting and unexpected relationships. And
yes,
you're right, Lankford, you know, he was about the story. The story was number one, and he developed whatever contacts he needed to get the story. One of them was with Bull Connor and access to City Hall, etc.
Some of the other characters that were involved, I was happy to see that there were white Lutheran pastors and Episcopalian priests and so forth, and Unitarians who all stood with the civil rights movement. But there were also gradations on both sides of that, which I had really not been aware of that before. There were those pastors who were and rabbis who were really upset with Dr. King's letters from a Birmingham jail, because they felt like, gee, we've been with you all along, and now you're kind of, in modern parlance, throwing us under the bus, because he had finally decided that gradualism was not working, and we need to change now. And some of these guys had been on that continuum for some time, but were not ready to make the full push forward, I suppose.
Yes, that is one of the ironies, is that King came after, you know, the very people who were not entirely in his camp, because these people felt that race relations needed to begin with conversations and not necessarily demonstrations. And they were worried about the demonstrations and worried that they would lead to violence. As happened, none of King's participants were violent, but the other people who were watching did erupt in violence,
right,
several times. Thankfully, no one was killed, but they could have been.
Yeah.
And so, you know, you if you put yourself back in that time frame, you can understand the concern that people had.
Sure, sure.
That's not to say that people were not, or that is to say, people still were not as dedicated as they should have been towards the cause, or as forthright. But I gained a new respect for all those people after having immersed myself in their world,
right,
and understanding how difficult it was.
And on the other side of the fence too, there were African American pastors who were concerned about putting their children out front, for example, in the children's protest and so forth. They were concerned because there had been a lot of violence, and they didn't think that their children were going to be immune to that. And I know I'm getting ahead. I want to say that this was a very complicated situation in Birmingham, and there were not just two sides. There were practically a dozen sides of gradations of from the ardent segregationist to the integration now or else. There's a lot of gray in between, wasn't there?
There was, and to me that was the big lesson that I learned from writing this, is it's complicated. History is complicated.
Yes.
And we are, you know, as human beings, we're kind of wired to want things to be simple.
Yeah.
That's how we learn things, and that's how we, you know, it takes some effort to understand how complex and multi-hued, as you say,
yeah,
history really is. But I think that it is very important understanding that, so we can apply that to today.
There were two big events. We're talking to award-winning author and former police captain T.K. Thorne of Birmingham in her new book, Behind the Magic Curtain, from New South Books, which is out of Montgomery, Alabama. And I kind of broke down as I was taking notes, as I was reading the book, that there were a couple of events in particular that took place in certain years leading up to the biggest confrontation. In 61, you had the Bloody Mother's Day with the Freedom Fighters. And then in October, a big thing that a judge orders Birmingham's parks and public facilities to be integrated, and the reaction of the city council was, oh, okay, we'll just close them all. And that was just on this continuum of what was happening in and around the city.
Right. One of my favorite quotes from a Jewish attorney who was very outspoken, his name was Abe Berkowitz. At the time, the idea had been floated that perhaps the city should just sell the parks rather than integrate them. And Berkowitz wrote a letter to the editor and said, my preference would be to keep the parks and sell Bull Connor.
He was not the only one that felt that way either.
Yeah.
Now, the next year, it starts off very badly. Three black churches are bombed in the first part of January of 62. Boycotts take place and are successful. And then something that I had not learned about until I read your book, that in November of that year, the citizens of Birmingham voted to change from the three at-large commission system to the mayor-council form of government, which we didn't do in Troy and Pike County until 1980 or so. So Birmingham was way ahead on that, and this was going to be part of what affected the enormous amount of authority that Bull Connor wielded, correct?
It would knock him his position completely out, and he would have to run for mayor under that new system. And he had just won with like a landslide, and he would have been entrenched in office had they not done this. But
right.
This was a huge effort, and it was led by a man who had fought desegregation efforts. So that was interesting. Sid Smyer became convinced that Birmingham's economy had to get out from under Bull Connor and his like.
You wrote about the merchants of Birmingham and the Chamber of Commerce was concerned that Birmingham had quit growing. In fact, were losing industries, lost the Delta Hub, for example, that went to Atlanta. And the business community was very concerned about what can we do to keep our city going.
Right. And, you know, in Birmingham is known as the Magic City because in the late 1870s, it was discovered that all the elements needed to make steel existed right there in close proximity to each other, which was a real boon and put Birmingham on the map. As a boom town, and that it just exploded, and so it was called the Magic City because of that growth. But the mining industry had the whole community under their thumbs, and they didn't want it any different because they had a very good deal as far as the labor market and what they had to pay for that, and that any kind of expansion of other service areas would cut into their lock on the labor market.
Now, 1963, you describe as the year of infamy. It starts out, Wallace has been elected for his first term as governor, and he is absolutely determined to say that segregation is the way it should be. It always has been. It always will be. This offends all kinds of people to have him speaking this way, but that's what got him elected. And he's going to say, from this point forward, what it takes to get elected. There's some happy things. There's a new sheriff who is not like Bull Connor. His name was Mel Bailey. You want to kind of walk us through 1963. That was really the biggest. This is when Birmingham became known nationally as Bombingham because of the, even though there had been some bombings earlier, it escalated dramatically in 1963.
Right. With the things that happened in 63 were, you know, this at the beginning in the spring was when everything came to a head in Birmingham. And the city had just made this landmark election where they had changed the form of government. And then Bull Connor ran for mayor and he lost. Which said a lot about where people were, but it was it would have been 50-50 without the black vote. But that pushed it over the edge. Scarce as it was, there were enough votes there. But then Connor decided to sue rather than leave office. So there was a time in Birmingham when there were actually two sets of government in City Hall, literally. And neither one of them knew how it would turn out. But Connor still maintained his grip, even after the election, because he had filed this lawsuit. And so he was still in control when Martin Luther King started the marches in Birmingham, Operation C for Confrontation, it was called. And that made all the difference. If Connor had just stepped down, you know, I don't know how history would have played out, but I'm betting it would have been different. Because they had Connor there. He was responsible for the confrontation in the park, the dogs and hoses, and the children that put Birmingham on the map. And then after that, you can't blame the bombing of the 16th Street Baptist Church on Connor. That was the Klan's doing.
Right.
But that also was a huge blow and shook the city. Although I will say there were some people who, you know, really didn't care. But a lot of people did. And it also got the attention, and probably those two things combined led to the passing of the 1964 civil rights legislation in Congress.
Right, right.
But the other thing that it did, when Connor fortunately lost his lawsuit, and the new mayor and city council took over, and one of the things they did, which I've not been able to find this happening in any other city in the country, was that they, in one swoop, they ruled against all of the Jim Crow laws in the city. They took them down in one swoop. So it was just an interesting juxtaposition in history of forces of all kinds.
We have, in 1963, we have thousands of children being arrested and held. We have the union bails the children out of jail, which no one would have expected that. Attempts to bomb synagogues backfire on the attempted bombers, and then bring even more sympathy for the civil rights movement. And I found it very interesting how deeply tied Jewish people in Birmingham were with the civil rights movement, which led to another surprise that it seems like a lot of Birmingham in those days was very anti-Semitic. For you and me both, who came after World War II, it always kind of seemed to me that after the Nazis' horror was unveiled, after the Holocaust was revealed, how could Americans still treat Jews differently? But apparently there were some that managed to do that. And that, to me, is another great shame, not just in Birmingham, but around the country, that Americans would somehow look down on Jews or consider them to be lesser Americans. That just boggles my mind.
Well, the mood in America before the war was very anti-Semitic.
Yeah.
In fact, Hitler modeled some of the Nuremberg laws on how, you know, blacks were treated in the South, but also we had figures like Henry Ford who promoted anti-Semitism, and his newspaper had a huge reach in America. So,
so
all of that was there. And, you know, I think it's been said very recently that hate doesn't go away; it just hides.
Yeah, that's the truth. Let's face it, we have hate in the world because we're broken people living in a broken world, and it's never going to go away. It might change forms, or it might be sneakier, and maybe not as overt, but that doesn't mean that it's going to vanish from the face of the earth, sadly enough. And no one people is responsible for all the racism in the world, or all the hate in the world. And that is both comforting, weirdly, but also terribly, terribly sad. There's no shortage of people who are perfectly determined to kill each other around the world, is there?
I could not have put that better.
What was the, of all the research that you did for this book, and it obviously was a labor of love and a lot of work, because you have all kinds of information that I've never read anywhere else about, not just the city of Birmingham during the civil rights movement, but about the state of Alabama. And I came from Florida, and I found out once I moved up here that Florida wasn't nearly as clean of racial problems as I thought it was when I was a little kid, because they just didn't report about them in the newspaper.
And
I asked my wife, who grew up in Troy, was born and raised here, I said, you know, as I was reading the book, I have this habit of interrupting her and saying, hey, listen to what I just read in this book. And she's very very patiently, after 46 years, goes, okay, hon. And I said, so did you see these, you know, the fire hoses on the kids and the dogs and all that stuff? Did you see that in newspapers or on television or anything? She said, no. And she said, I had no idea what was going on, you know, 150 miles north of us. It wasn't in the local newspapers, and we didn't watch television news in those days. There you go.
And a lot of people in Birmingham didn't know either. They got their news from the national news. Once the children came out, then the national media came down. And you know, after those kind of confrontations, even the Birmingham news started reporting things on the front page that had made, you know, had not made it in the news at all, or was on the back pages.
Was there one thing that was the biggest surprise to you about all the, with all the research you did, was there one thing that just absolutely shocked you when you discovered it?
One thing that shocked me was an incident that Tom Lightford reported that I'd never heard before and never read in any history book, and I don't want to give away everything in the book. He learned about an assassination attempt that had happened
right
years before. That shocked me. But the thing that really the overall thing, I guess, was developing a real or a deeper understanding of how alone white people were that stood up. You know, all my life I've read about, you know, black people and how they, you know, risked their lives, which they did. Not to take anything away from what happened on the streets and what people did to try to claim their freedom.
Here's
an example. There was a group of 72 white people that went, started in Birmingham, that went down to Selma to march to the courthouse there in protest of the restrictions and the challenges that black people were having trying to vote and register to vote. I never heard of that. It completely got lost in history, and that was something that happened prior to Bloody Sunday.
Yeah, and you mentioned sometimes there were white teenagers that reached out to black teenagers, inviting them to church with them and stuff, and this resulted in extreme ostracism for them, or in some cases, violence against them. One guy, I don't remember the particulars, but this stuck it out in my mind, that he was attacked by a bunch of older boys and hung by his foot from a tree. As a means of intimidating him to quit doing that. It was a very dangerous time to be seen as one who was sympathetic with the civil rights movement if you were Caucasian. It could be very dangerous, and the Klan didn't discriminate in who they would just as readily kill somebody like that as they would anybody else.
Absolutely, and the thing about it was that those people were so, had no big community supporting them.
Right.
They were very isolated, and to me, that is really, really tough. I have a tiny little taste of what it feels like to have some of your own turn against you.
Yeah.
And it's a very isolating experience. So I've gained a lot of respect for the people who did that, regardless of the risk to themselves and their family and their means of earning a living.
Yeah.
All of those things were threatened.
This story is certainly loaded with heroes and villains and a lot of people in between, and people who were confused and not sure how to react, and those who stepped up and did the right thing for whatever, and even if their reasons weren't always pure, they certainly did what they felt like was best for the city of Birmingham and for African Americans. So it is a fascinating story and very well done. And TK, is there anything else that you wished I'd ask you, but I didn't?
No. We don't have another couple of hours to talk, so I think you did a great job, and I'm so glad that the book resonated with you.
Yeah, absolutely. I'm looking forward to them providing me with a physical copy. I'm glad to have a digital copy to read, but I don't feel like it's right to loan a digital copy to somebody else. That really is artistic theft, but. I don't mind loaning a physical copy of a book to one of my sons or anything like that. I know that it isn't going to keep them from buying a copy of their own once they start to read it. So
right. Well, the published date is at the end of this month, but I understand that New South has been went ahead and sent the book out to people who purchased it through them.
Okay, excellent.
So that's a little hint if anybody wants to get it quick.
Yes, and their website is pretty simple, isn't it? NewSouthBooks.com?
Yes.
Yeah. And do you?
And also on my website, I was going to say, on the front page of my website, I have all about this book, and if you scroll down to the bottom, there's some quick links to New South and to other bookstores and to, you know, Amazon, where it is on Amazon and Barnes & Noble, et cetera.
Very good.
So my website is tkthorne, TKThorne.com.
Okay. Simple to remember. All right. We'll mention that again in the wrap-up, too. All right. TK,
okay,
thank you.
I enjoyed
getting a chance to talk with you about your book, which is quite an extraordinary book. And thank you for making time to talk to us here on the bookshelf.
Thank you, and thank you for the speed dating through history. My goodness. You did great.
Well, thank you very much. Our thanks again to former police captain T.K. Thorne. Her new book, Behind the Magic Curtain, from New South Books out of Montgomery, Alabama. Their website is newsouthbooks.com. Her website is T.K. Thorne, that's T-H-O-R-N-E.com. We'll see you next time right here on your favorite radio stations and hopefully your favorite podcast on thebookshelf.podbean.com. Until then, I'm your host, Dave Doc Kirby. Thanks for listening, and God bless.